session number 22636, Reel 6. Captain Wright, Reel 6. You mentioned other locations besides the Rysat Ridge. In particular, going down to Alam Halfa. What happened down there? Why were you moved to Alam Halfa?
Well, on the 30th of August, I think it was, Rommel made his last thrust, which was down in the south, and his idea was to do much the same as Ghazala, to come through at the south of the minefield and swing round north.
And outflank.
Outflank, yes. And we were designated to build a minefield in double-quick time, east-west, to isolate him
Stop him coming north.
Yes.
As he got through.
He couldn't go south because of the Qatar depression.
Yes.
And so we were trying to restrain him, or constrain him. And so we did this. In fact, such as this bears out my feeling that people have to be informed of what's going on, otherwise you never know where you are. I was second in command of the convoys. I mean, my job was to pick up stragglers and take them to where we were going. And we're bowling along due east. The battle had been going for about a day, I suppose. And I suddenly became aware of a staff car, an open staff car, to the south of me, off our line of march. And I thought, well, I'm here to pick up stragglers. It doesn't matter if they're not our unit. I better go and see what's happening. So I dashed over there, stopped at the regulation distance away, walked across the interval, and there was this humble staff car with the bonnet up, steam coming out of the engine, a sergeant driver looking in it rather disconsolately, a very ancient looking, sort of pinched features general standing there wearing shorts and a hat with a red band, and a 11th Hussar officer with the funny berries they had, and a fly whisk, sort of like this, you see. And rather stupidly, as I'm prone to do, I stopped and said, I think it was a general, I said, anything wrong, sir? To which his reply was, of course, Ridge, you don't think I want to stop here, do you? And I thought, well, they might want to stop here, how do I know? So I bottled myself up and went to have a look in the under the engine, under the bonnet, and he'd lost a fan belt, you see, and the whole thing was boiling over. So I said, well, I think we'll have to tow you. I had a perfectly good vehicle, you see. Where do you want to go? He said, well, Army headquarters, of course, Burgal Arab. And I thought, well, this chap isn't very polite, is he? So I said, right, well, I'll take you there. And I suddenly thought, wait a minute, because I was frequently checked by senior officers if they asked where to go, why I hadn't checked their identity. I might be Rommel, you see. So I thought, I want to be careful, here's a full general. So I said, could I see your identity card, sir? Whereupon his ADC, that's who he was, said, don't be a fool, don't you know it's the army commander? And it was Montgomery. And I'd asked him for his identity card, which must have damaged his self-esteem very much, I think. And I didn't know. I mean, the chap, as far as I was concerned, was walking left, but he'd been given the sack. So we came over the truck and hooked him up, and off we went. Now, I knew where Burgal Arab was. All I got to do was go the coast road and along it. But I knew how to get there straight across, because I knew what the bearing was. And I suddenly thought, wait a minute, this is a worm turning again. I thought, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go down one of these strategic tracks, which were the LFC thing. The LFC transport came down. It was about that deep in finely blown dust, you see. So I went to this and turned into it, went down it, and I looked through my rearview mirror, and all I could see was a tow chain disappearing into a cloud of dust. And that was a worm turning. And of course, when I delivered him and waited for thanks, which were not forthcoming, I was then saddled with the thing of finding my unit again, which I did in due course, arrived late, explained, thinking that they'd get a signal to say thank you very much for Lieutenant White giving me a lift from the Army Commander. Hit my 2IC, gave him this thing which he didn't believe, and that was another blot on my copy book. But that was life.
How much did you know of the big picture then when you were at RUISAT and subsequently? Were you able to keep in touch with divisional developments or corps or army developments at all?
Well, yes, I was constantly asking what was happening, and I suppose we got, I forget how we got told, but I was at pains to tell my chaps what was happening, which involved me again in an unfortunate, well, it wasn't unfortunate, but it was unexpected. I used to sit down near the Jemadar's dugout with the NCOs in a circle, sit down on the ground, with a hubble bubble in the middle, you see, and they'd, I mean, it wasn't mine, they always had one, and they handed this thing round. And I don't smoke, but I thought, well, I'm not going to be toffee-nosed, so I put the thing through my fingers like that and sucked the thing, the smoke in through my cupped hands. And I noticed that my head spun every time I did this. It wasn't until about 18 months later that I found that I was smoking pot.
But they were using cannabis in the Hubble bubble.
Yeah, well, it was tobacco as well, I think.
Yeah, a mixture of cannabis and tobacco.
But it was all totally alien to me, so I wouldn't have known. But
was that in regular use amongst Indian troops?
Must have been, yeah. Well, of course, the Sikhs had never, because they didn't smoke. But these were Gwalias, and they obviously did. But such are the rigours of service life.
Well, the British soldier had his brew, didn't he? His tea at regular intervals.
Oh, yes.
And there'd be a mutiny if that didn't turn up.
Well, these chaps had their brew as well, of course.
They
did.
Mm.
Yes.
So they had tea and cannabis.
Yes.
So you said you'd sit them round on the... so would that happen every day, if it was practical to brief
Well,
them?
No, whenever there was an operation coming off, or there was some news about some big battle that had been won, I'd tell them that this thing, you see. Because I was very conscious of how dreadful it is to be in the middle of something like that without knowing what's going on.
How did you find out what was going on or what had been going
I'm
on?
I'm trying to remember. I suppose we'd be shown an operation order, and then I'd pass that on.
I mean, was there a sort of morning prayers within the field company every day or something of that sort at which you'd be given a...
No, nothing like that. They'd have that at brigade, of course.
Yes, but you wouldn't go to brigade, presumably.
No. We had to pick up the scraps that we could, I think.
How did your orders arrive then? Would you simply be called to the company headquarters, or would someone from company headquarters come down to see you and tell you what they wanted you to do next?
Well, we're all on the same spot geographically, yes. But they'd come and tell us what we had to do, yes. So we were reasonably in the picture. But it had to be passed on to the men, and so that was my duty, I think.
But when you got your orders, were they normally written or were they usually verbal?
Oh, practically always verbal. I mean, we'd see an operation order. I've got one or two still, but mainly those happened when I was under command, which made being under command so much better altogether.
Were the Indian soldiers, were the ordinary sappers, were they interested in what was going on?
Oh, very much, yes indeed. Yes. I don't think if you'd asked them exactly which unit was where, they'd have known, but they wanted to know roughly in which direction we were going and what the programme was.
So they were just in general background of what they were doing now or going to be doing next.
Yes. Well, I mean, half the idea that was born out to me, particularly at Oxford, when you'd be on a night exercise and you'd be walking along the middle of the night with the back of the pack of the fellow in front of you, a few inches from your nose, going up and down. It was all very soporific, and then suddenly he'd stop and you'd run into him, and the first question would be, "What's this?" "Oh, I don't know." And the next question was always, "Well, how long is it going to be? Do you think we've got time to get our pack off or have a kip or something?" And one never knew, and that was the thing that really triggered this feeling of necessity of putting people in the picture, because if you can have a quick kip for about half an hour, I mean, you're fine. But seldom it filters through to that level.
One thing is that Montgomery was apparently very keen that soldiers should be put into the picture and should know everything they needed to know, as long as it didn't compromise security. But doesn't seem to work with his own appointment, as far as you are concerned.
Well, I must say he had an antipathy for the Indian Army. I think it was born of the fact that he didn't pass out high enough from Sandhurst to qualify. I know it sounds spiteful of me, but he did have a sort of chip somehow. And I remember after Alamein, 4th Indian Division, which is what we were then, which was one of the three divisions that started the whole thing off, along with 7th Armoured and 7th Armoured, 4th Indian, oh, 2nd New Zealand. We thought we were the crème de la crème. But after Alamein, we were put on salvage collection. That's what he thought of us. We were the last division for him to come and visit. One got the idea that he didn't like us, which, as far as I'm concerned, was mutual.
You mentioned Auchinleck. I mean, were you aware of his presence when you were in the field, when you joined the field company?
Oh, very much so, yes. Well, the funny thing was, his old battalion was in my brigade, the 1st West Punjab. And so he visited us quite a lot. But he was a splendid fellow, I think. I mean, he didn't appoint his army commanders. I think he had. I mean, Ritchie was a disaster, wasn't he? Really was. I mean, there was the Africa Corps sitting there for the picking, waiting for petrol to come, and he did nothing. We did little sort of piecemeal attacks on them. Dreadful, dreadful, dreadful. Why they ever had him as a corps commander again? He was a corps commander in Normandy, wasn't he?
Ritchie.
Yes, I think he came back, didn't he?
Don't think so. No, Connor did.
Connor did. Yeah, he was
Yeah,
splendid. Yes.
yeah. Eighth. He had 8th Corps in Normandy.
Yes. And Ritchie didn't. Oh, well, that's good, because no, I think Ritchie was a disaster. I mean, historically, from what I read, I wasn't there at the time. But Gazala was dreadful.
You were saying you were heading down towards Alam Halfa to create this defensive minefield to keep the Africa Corps from moving north. I mean, was that done? Did the
Oh,
minefield get laid on the.
yes. Poor old Rom, I mean, he was on at odds of 2-1 against, I think. He had practically no fuel. And I think he had to decide, if he hadn't done something, achieved something, by the end of day one, that he'd had it, and he just had to go back. And on his way back, facing towards him, he came across the 6-pounders, which had newly arrived, and they knocked hell out of him. So one shouldn't feel like that, I suppose, about one's enemy, but he was a very Nazi general too, wasn't he?
He was, yes.
But I had a friend who was captured twice. He was in the in 2nd New Zealand, which I have evidence of in Rommel's papers was the Allied division that he respected most. And they were all grouped in a sort of cage somewhere out there in North Africa. And Rommel arrived and said, "Have you any complaints, gentlemen?" in English. One bloke said, "Yes, General, we've had no water for 6 hours." He said, "I am sorry, but that is war, gentlemen. Neither have my troops." And off he went. Now, a chap who troubles to do that has got something good in him, I think. Well, they were very impressed.
What happened after this Alam Halfa movement? Did you go back up to the Alamein?
Yes, we went up there and prepared for the Battle of Alamein, the Second Battle of Alamein.
What did you have to do in preparation for that battle?
I think it was just mine clearing. And I think we'd got Polish mine detectors by then, and so we started training on those.
How did they work?
Rather sporadically. They tended to sort of scream every now and again. But
was this like the metal detector of day?
But we had no... yes, we did. We had one chap who stepped on an S mine. He was very badly wounded. But otherwise... We got it through with very few casualties.
When the detectors were working, did they make a significant difference, the speed with which you...
Oh, much, yes. Yeah. So you could do it a third of the time.
Oh.
Yes. Definitely. Yes, that was a great advantage. Mm-hmm. But then I seem to remember what would happen was if they found a scream from somewhere, they'd... pointed out, we put a cone down, and the chap would come along with a bayonet
and prod.
And prod, yes. But no, it did quicken it up very much. Mm.
How long did it take for your sappers to get used to this new device and get good at using it?
Not very long. They were very good on that sort of thing. I mean, everything was novel to them, but they were splendid.
What about the actual attack itself? What part did you play in that when they...
Well, we were right down in the south by then. And
had you been moved again?
Yes. Yeah. I think... Wait a minute, we weren't... No, we weren't particularly in the south. No, we weren't. No, we were on the same line because we came out at the Deir el Maria. Yes. I don't know why I should say that. I know what it was. We had one brigade... which went up north to help 51st, I think.
Highland Division.
Yes. But we continued. I can remember... this wasn't on the 23rd. On the 23rd, we were sort of held in reserve or something. But about 3 days after the 23rd, we started going forward and clearing this gap in the minefield. And there were a whole series of minefields, and we were doing this pretty extensively. And a jeep rolled up, and it was my colonel, Colonel Blundell. And he stopped me. He was a very outgoing sort of chap. And he asked me how things were going, and he said, "Right, well, hop in, they can look after it all right." So I hopped in the car, and off we went due west, you see, with him driving. And we went into a depression, and big rocks, about this sort of size, everywhere. And we drove between them. It was quite easy going between them. And we were bowling along, and suddenly there was a crack just by my left ear. I can remember, I looked round, and the colonel, who was alongside me, looked round as well. And then there was a bullet going past our ears, you see. And so dear old John Blundell looked straight ahead, put his foot down the accelerator, went bounding ahead. And sure enough, hang on for when an Italian soldier got up from behind this rock with his hands in the air, you see, and John Brown, who was tallest chap, leapt out of this jeep and rushed over to this chap, bent down, picked his rifle up, and threw it as far as he could into the far distance, you see, gripped him by the shoulders, turned him round until he was facing due east, took three paces back and two running paces forward and kicked him straight in the bottom, and so he fell on his face, dragged him to his feet, pointed due east and gave him a shove, and off he went. And never said a word at all. It was all sort of...
all pantomime.
Yes, wonderful. He was a great chap. He got killed at Wadi Akarit in Tunisia. Nice chap.
Were there any other Italian soldiers in the area that you saw, or was it this Italian?
No, but at some stage, because we were sent up north to clear an enormous minefield there, we saw a whole line of these people as POWs going back. And the interesting thing was there's always a sharp division between the Italians and the Germans. The Germans wouldn't go anywhere near them. They were the same line, but there was a sort of a great gap between one and the other.
This minefield you're clearing, you mentioned anti-tank mines and you mentioned an S mine. Did the Germans normally lay purely anti-tank or purely anti-personnel, or did they mix them up?
Oh, no. I mean, just before old John Blunder arrived, I was going ahead and seeing what was in these minefields, so I could write it out and say, right, there were so many lines. And I could see a line, about four lines, of telemines, because the wind used to sweep the sand off some of them, you see, so they'd be sticking up proud, and you could see them perfectly easily. And overcome with self-confidence, I rushed across, you see, and measured these things out, wrote it down a piece of paper, turned to come back out of the minefield, looked down, and there was a row of about seven of these, well, about seven rows of anti-personnel, of S mines. They'd have three little spring steel, tungsten steel, sort of spikes sticking up. And when you trod on that, it would detonate underneath, and something would fly up about the size of a pound jam pot until it was that height.
And then chest height.
And then it would explode. Mm. And it took all your guts out. That's how he didn't die, funny enough. All his guts came out, and they carted him off, operated on him the same day, and he was back in Royal Quay in no time flat. But I saw these mines, which I'd walked over through, and I could see where my footsteps were, and I could see where these mines. I had to sit down. I was so horrified.
How close had you got to the problems?
Yeah.
A few inches away.
Yes.
Were these mines close together?
Oh, no. Yeah. Well, no, they were about that far, I suppose.
About 4 foot apart.
Mm. But I tell you a thing which booby traps, which are much the same, but there's more sort of psychological twist about them. I was tearing ahead again and looking to see what was ahead so that we could know what we had to clear. And I came across a landing strip that the RAF had had, I suppose, because there were some 500-pound bombs there, enormous things, in a pile. And by one of them, there was a piece of signal wire, which you could see from bloody miles off, stretched between two pickets, you see. And did it have an igniter attached? No, I don't think so. Yes, it did. Anyway, I put a pin in the igniter, and I thought, what a crude thing, and I was full of contempt for who'd ever put it there. And I grabbed one of these pickets to pull it out and sort of throw it away, and I suddenly got this alarm bell in my head. I could think of the chap who was laying it and thinking what a typical reaction would be, which is exactly what mine would be. And I knelt down and dug under this picket And there was a pin and a piece of wire going down to an igniter at the bottom, and a bit of green fuse going to TNT under this bomb. And I don't, if I'd pulled it out, I wouldn't be here now. Yeah. Mm. But it was a kind of contact with an unknown person who put it there.
Like doing a crossword puzzle in a way.
Yes, yes.
So the battle of wits then, yes. Sapper v. Sapper on each side.
Yes.
When did you first start having those booby traps? Was that in the El Alamein battle or later?
No, the Japs didn't have them. They had these punches, which...
When did you first encounter booby traps? Did you have those at El Alamein, or was it after El Alamein that...
Oh, no, before El Alamein.
Before El Alamein.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Mm. Well, they had them sometime. But they were always having new things coming, and they had one which I think they must have heard about our flail tanks, because they had one which was so designed, when a flail tank hit this thing, a charge would go up under the flail tank.
Right.
So, now they've been constant development, and they were very clever and beautifully done. Mm. Made by slave labour, I expect. But, yes, it was, the absurd thing was to see me standing up talking half German and half Urdu to a lot of my troops who must have... And they just sort of accepted all this.
And they managed to pick it up as they went along.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were saying you had to clear a big minefield. Was this for the exploitation force to go through after?
I don't know why it was there. It was a great big rectangular thing, but didn't really hold up any east or west movement. Another psychological twist, it had a notice. Il Giardino di... What's the devil? Di Diablo, that's right.
The devil's garden.
Yes.
Yeah.
And superimposed on it, a notice about twice the size, written in German, was the Teufelsgarten. As if to say, we are the bosses here. And that was full of all sorts of funny things, yes.
What sorts of funny things?
It had Italian mines as well, but they were pretty stupid, I suppose. But it had quite a lot of these telemines, the anti-tank mines, with anti-handling devices on. Obviously, somebody had done this at some leisure and decided he was going to make a job of it.
Did you have to clear just lanes through, or the whole thing?
That's quite a point. It didn't seem to be any point in putting lanes in. I can't really remember. I think we must have been clearing the whole thing. Mm. Yes, I think it was part of this dreadful salvaging operation that we were doing.
So this was after the battle had moved westward.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yes, because we had no mobility then at all. So we were... No, it was a horrid feeling there. We'd been at the very beginning. We'd fought well. And we've been left out. Mm. So I've never been a Monty fan since.
How long did it take to actually do this clearance of the Devil's Garden?
Well, I suppose we broke through from Alamein on November the 3rd, or was it the 5th? I think within a month we'd been taken out entirely and sent back to the Delta. I don't know if we ever completed it, actually.
You said you had no mobility. What mobility did you have normally?
All the units could travel on their own, but we had...